Save big money when you start your next project today at Menards. Convert your current recessed lighting with energy-saving LED downlights from Fight Electric. They're bright and install easily in just minutes. They also go from regular lighting to nightlight mode with just a simple flip of a switch. Save big on all Fight lighting products now at Menards. Shop our lighting options today in-store and on Menards.com.
Save big money at Menards.
This is Speaking Freely. I'm Annette Newell. They joined forces to fight fentanyl in Oregon, declaring a 90-day emergency. The top elected leaders of Oregon, Multnomah County, and Portland announced it together. Multnomah County Chair Jessica Vega Peterson, Mayor Ted Wheeler, and Governor Tina Kotek say they've been working on it for months. And this week, Multnomah County leaders and experts held a hearing about what exactly this emergency order means, what it will do. First, we hear from Multnomah County Chair Jessica Vega Peterson.
Tuesday, January 30th, Governor Kotek, Mayor Wheeler, and I declared a state of emergency to address the fentanyl crisis in Portland Central City in Multnomah County. I issued both a statement of emergency to address the fentanyl crisis in Portland Central City and in Multnomah County. The statement of emergency authorizes the county to act as an emergency management agency, and the emergency exemption coordinates the purchase of goods and services to address this emergency. I'm requesting that the board join me in taking action and declare a 90-day emergency under Chapter 25 of the County Code. I'm going to share more about the background of this resolution, the accompanied unified command that we are standing to support this initiative, and the county's goals, objectives, and approaches that we can bring to this tri-governmental effort. So the recommendations to declare a 90-day tri-governmental fentanyl emergency came from the Governor's Central City Task Force. The committee recommended both a 90-day emergency declaration and the establishment of a command center in the Central City focused on enhancing coordination among the state, county, and city. The state, county, city, and this board recognize the urgency to act with shared leadership and respond to the very human toll fentanyl is taking. I know from many of our discussions that declaring this emergency has been a priority for you as well, and I am appreciative of your leadership because we know that despite past actions, we have seen fatal opioid overdoses increase fivefold from 2018 to 2022, including a record high 209 people in Multnomah County losing their lives from overdoses involving fentanyl in 2022. We know that many of these deaths are due to the changes in potency of substances and the methods of substance delivery. We also know that these deaths are compounded by social factors, including increased isolation, economic challenges, housing shortages, instability, and systemic racism. It is so important that we step forward with the state of Oregon and the city of Portland to quickly establish better systems of coordination to reduce fentanyl deaths and fentanyl activities on our streets and in our communities. In conjunction with the declaration, the state, county, and city established a unified command to focus on identifying and building coordinated efforts and systems to address fentanyl in more collaborative and streamlined ways. I know each of us has a great deal to contribute to the county response to this crisis. Some of us, like Commissioner Myron, have subject matter expertise in the healthcare spaces or engage locally and nationally in traveling to understand best practices from providers and experts. We have heard and seen the impacts of this crisis on our neighbors, families, first responders, healthcare providers, and people in recovery. All of us has prioritized a pathway forward. Today's declaration helps us take a more comprehensive public health approach that prevents exposure to and initiation of fentanyl, reduces harms among people using substances, and increases access to outreach, treatment, and recovery services. We do not start this work from scratch. As our local public health and mental health authority, Multnomah County has worked closely with people who use drugs for decades. We partner with community organizations, service providers, and state agencies across the four key areas of prevention, harm reduction, connection to services and treatment, and ongoing recovery support. This has been and must continue to be a community-wide effort. But with this declaration comes a new opportunity for coordinated urgency, for partnership, for response to meet the needs of our entire community. We also know that every approach to this work needs to address the inequity, trauma, and despair that drives much of the substance use within our communities. When I talk about the community, and about this work, I am speaking about our entire county, from East County and East Portland to the West Hills and our unincorporated regions. This emergency gives us a chance to meet the ongoing and emerging threat and expand what we know works to every part of Multnomah County. This includes programs like targeted screening in our student health centers to identify opioid misuse, increased naloxone distribution and training, increased outreach visibility and coordination. Within our corrections health, we are engaged in transition planning and pathways to treatment and reduction of stigma through mentorship, support, and public education. My biggest priority in joining the state and the city in their declarations are making sure that the incident commanders develop goals, strategies, and metrics, and that they are all incorporating a public health lens and ensuring that this good work and these learnings were not just benefiting only the central city, but every part of this county. And at the end of the 90 days, I expect to see pathways for long-term sustained tri-governmental system coordination. As we begin doing this work in a new aligned way, I am committed to more directly connecting the work of every county department with these efforts. I am also committed to working closely with each of you in the county's efforts over the next 3 months in all the work that will follow.
And that was Multnomah County Chair Jessica Vega Peterson. Jana Popeff-Thimu is Oregon State Resilience Officer and a Policy Advisor on Emergency Response for Governor Tina Kotek, adding to this conversation.
There's so much suffering in the world, and fentanyl and its impacts on communities are often such a discouraging topic. And I'm really happy to be present for something that I think has a sparkle of promise and hope. I want to thank Multnomah County for their partnership and their willingness to invest in additional collaboration, even at a time that your systems are stretched. And I'd like to especially appreciate the awesome, capable powerhouse women that you have assigned to work with us on this. Leah, Rachel, Nisha, Jen, Alice, you've given us a top-tier team, and we met for the first time. It was pretty exciting after so much that's been said and hashed and rehashed to see people just walk up and say, okay, what's working? And start to write out, like, where can we focus? Where can we build? And it was just that sense of problem solving together with the state, the city, and the county all in the same room, looking for gaps and looking for hope was awesome. I also want to thank you for the work that led to that meeting. There was a lot of energy to ensure the declarations are in alignment, that we have a shared commitment to deploying our resources collectively in a coordinated way to get the maximum benefit out of all the energy and people, time, and money that we're already putting into it. I know an important outcome of this work that we've established and practice systems of operational coordination that can extend far beyond this 90-day declaration. The other important element is going to be a focus on data, on having measurable outcomes, about sharing and using data that goes across platforms, across employers, to really inform decisions and help us see that we're making progress in a meaningful way. Unified Command just met for the first time, so I want to give them a minute to develop their strategies and tell us what they think the meaningful metrics will be. They will have the opportunity to make resource requests to support the strategies that they bring forward. And I know their experiences over the course of these 90 days will help us see what are the most promising approaches. They'll highlight gaps that we can address in the longer term, too. In 90 days, we expect to see measurable improvement in downtown Portland and the basis for longer term coordination and action based on shared experiences and joint success. So on behalf of the governor and Oregon, I want to thank you again sincerely for your willingness to partner, your contributions to the work, and your commitment to shared leadership for the benefit of people who are impacted by fentanyl, for their loved ones, and for the wider community.
Jana Popeff-Thimu is Oregon State Resilience Officer. Rachel Banks is also involved in this fentanyl state of emergency as the Health Department Director.
This is an approach that really engages every corner of the Health Department and the county. It includes our clinical services. It includes our community-based services. It includes things that we do in corrections. It includes expertise from behavioral health fields, criminal justice fields, public health fields, really knitting them all together for maximum impact and collective impact. It just really reminds me of what drew me back to working in Multnomah County is the ability to work across and create these broad umbrellas, both clearly in the health department, but in the county, where these extremely brilliant people that I get to work with every day bring forward their full mission and can really see how we all contribute to a collective issue. We know that this crisis will not be solved in 90 days. We're both moving forward with a sense of urgency, but also we have been and will continue to be in this for the long haul. I want to clarify that when I talk about a public health approach, there are probably very few people who have not in some ways been touched by the impacts of fentanyl, overdose, or other addiction issues. It is an issue that touches people that we love in all sorts of systems that we work in. So really taking that population health approach is necessary because this is a challenge that we cannot solve alone. Secondly, really thinking about a comprehensive approach. For us, that means from prevention, including primary prevention, all the way through interventions and ultimately recovery. That also includes what we call the life course approach and intervening in key areas and key points in people's lives. So that means that we are working to prevent, mitigate adverse childhood experiences, working in our early childhood population, supporting families, supporting adults, adolescents, and people as they're entering correction systems or using substances. Public health approach is person-centered, trauma-informed, and understands that everybody is deserving of care and services, that we can continue to inspire hope, and that the situations we're in part are results of the environments that we're in and the systems that we're exposed to. We're ultimately trying to reach these health outcomes, some of them which take quite a while, but we continue to measure outputs and move towards strategies that get us there. This approach is also needed because substance use is an extremely complex issue that is impacted by a variety of factors. Those include personal, community, and family trauma. Those include generational patterns of addiction. They include economic factors, other injustices, and they include discrimination, oppression, and the impacts that leaves year after year, generation after generation on communities. And this issue requires a comprehensive approach because we need to be addressing the root causes, also acting in urgency and creating an umbrella of strategies and interventions. Our overarching goals in this 90-day period and beyond are to slow the rate of overdose deaths. We want to end those. Ultimately, we want to decrease those. And we know that we have seen increasing trends. And so we need to slow that rate on our mission to eliminate that. We're going to do that by preventing exposure to fentanyl and also preventing initiation by young people and other folks to substances. We're going to do that by reducing the harms for people that are using substances. And this also includes reducing overdoses and to increase access to outreach services, treatment, recovery, so folks are reintegrating into thriving supportive communities. So to talk more specifically about the objectives, these are in the Health Department's Overdose Prevention and Response Plan, which is really a launching point for the Health Department and also a rallying point or bridge to the larger county efforts. But this is what people in our community we'll see in the next 90 days. We will be launching a couple of communications campaigns that includes a youth-focused campaign, which is really meant to raise general awareness and also talk about the risks of fentanyl, particularly for young people, in the mediums and modes in which they communicate. We will also be distributing naloxone and providing trainings really through a cohesive plan to increase and distribute naloxone both in county buildings and other community settings. This will include the hiring a new position of a naloxone resource specialist. It will also include distribution and a sort of relaunch to get more people engaged in what our federally qualified health centers already offer in the pharmacy dispensing of naloxone. We want to make sure that people understand that and understand that's a resource to them. And looking and working with our partners to expand training for naloxone and overdose response for people in our community. We will also be increasing the visibility and coordination of a lot of our outreach services. Some of those include PATH, Old Town Inreach, our mental health care continuum coordination work, and harm reduction teams. This is all work that has been happening. These teams have been working, but this provides an opportunity to be coordinated and collaborative, particularly in a specific geographic area. It allows us to partner with additional programs throughout the county that have proven success and track records, and ultimately to coordinate with the state and our city partners with their outreach programs again. So all of these are really, once again, working across four areas in the plan, which are prevention, harm reduction, treatment, and recovery. And that is the umbrella that we will continue to work through, as well as our substance use, addiction, and treatment.
And that was Health Director Rachel Banks talking about the 90-day fentanyl state of emergency for Portland, Multnomah County in Oregon. Next, I talked to an award-winning author and professor who is making a special appearance in Portland on February 6th to speak for the Oregon Historical Society's Hatfield Lecture Series. Dr. Kelly Lytle Hernandez is a history professor at the University of California, Los Angeles, and she wrote the book Bad Mexicans, Race, Empire, and Revolution in the Borderlands.
Happy to come up there.
Yeah, we're excited to have you very soon coming here to Oregon. Have you been to Portland before or to Oregon?
Oh, but of course, yes. In fact, just this time last year, I was in Portland for nothing other than personal reasons, but a son and I went up there to go to Powell's and just take a shopping trip at the bookstore.
We were just there last night. They always have wonderful authors come in and talk, and so that's a great thing. But we're really excited to have you here for the Hatfield series and talk to you about your wonderful book, Bad Mexicans. It's got such a great title. And where did you come up with the title? It seems like the people you're talking about in this book are actually pretty heroic. I wouldn't see them as bad necessarily, right?
Yes, absolutely. And thank you for starting with the title of the book, which is certainly provocative. So the title of the book comes from language used by the dictator in Mexico at the turn of the 20th century, who disparaged dissidents against his regime by calling them Maos Mexicanos, or bad Mexicans. And I have to say that it's that language, that rhetoric, that jumped up out at me from the archive when Donald Trump was running for president the first time and started to disparage Mexican immigrants as bad hombres, that people who are seeking, fighting for a better life for themselves were being disparaged as bad hombres. And so what I wanted to do with this book is to talk about authoritative regimes, about dangerous rhetoric that is used to target people who challenge those regimes. And in this case, it's all Mexicans, whether they're simply migrants looking for a better life or they're political dissidents trying to change the arrangements of the world, meaning the political and economic arrangements of the world. So that's where the title comes from. It comes from the language of this dictator at the turn of the 20th century, but also that resonates with contemporary language from attempted autocrats.
Mm-hmm. You got there before I even had a chance to ask you about what you're thinking in terms of what's going on now when it comes to immigration reform and all the heated rhetoric in the presidential election and in many other elections across the country, rhetoric about immigration and what was happening during the period that you're covering in the book.
Yeah, that's such a good question in the sense, this is certainly heated rhetoric, right? Bad hombres or bad Mexicans. It's also extraordinarily dangerous. It triggers and it summons high levels of racial violence here in the United States. And one of the things that people will learn about in reading this book, Bad Mexican, is about that history of anti-Mexican violence in the United States. And the period that I'm talking about, the early 20th century, there are certainly moments and episodes in which vigilantes create lists of bad Mexicans and go out and hunt them down and subject Mexican Americans and Mexican nationals of the United States to extraordinary amounts of violence, including lynchings that surge in the 1910s around the time of the Mexican Revolution. So this language is incredibly dangerous. It dehumanizes people, but also summons this history that in many ways we've been taught to suppress, to forget, to overlook, but it lingers beneath the surface. And all it needs is for someone to come and tap into it. And then it surges once again. So that's part of what I'm doing here is try to make people aware of how this language is so incredibly dangerous and how it triggers racial violence here in the United States.
Mm-hmm. And you're doing this in a narrative form, though. A lot of the reviews of your books, they read like a novel, but yet you have really important history lessons in it that haven't been told in a lot of other places, this part of history that we're just now starting to focus on more. Do you think that we've turned a corner where people are more willing to see these parts of our history that aren't necessarily so great.
These are the debates that we're having right now, very much in the public square about American history and whose stories get to be told and how they get to be told. So this book is certainly a part of that conversation, that Mexican-American history is rarely chronicled in the canon of American history. It's seen as being off to the side or in the corner somewhere, not central to the making of the United States. But a couple of things I try to do in this book is, one, talk about how the rise in the United States of a global power, namely economic, but also the political power at the turn of the 20th century, cannot be understood without Mexico and U.S.-Mexico relations, that it in Mexico at the turn of the 20th century, that U.S. investors first try their hand at major foreign investments or the creation of U.S. imperialism. And so we learn our lessons about how to dominate foreign markets in Mexico. Another really important story here is that the rise in U.S. investment in Mexico is precisely what triggers mass labor migration from Mexico to the United States. So this idea that Mexican immigrants come here or immigrants come here without our own participation in the creation of those pathways of migration is something that we can look at historically and find to be grounded, that migration often requires routes and pathways for people to get somewhere. And capitalism often plays a large role in creating those routes and pathways. If we really want to understand racial violence in the United States and the long history of it, we've got to talk about Mexican-American history and policing here in the States.
I also wanted to ask you about million-dollar hoods, the work you're doing with that, mapping fiscal and human costs of mass incarceration in Los Angeles.
Oh, yes.
I just think that sounds really interesting.
So million-dollar hoods is a big data initiative where we collect up jail and police data, namely arrest data, and we calculate how much is being spent neighborhood to lock up residents of Los Angeles in the local jail system. And we found that there's more than 30 neighborhoods in Los Angeles where local authorities are spending more than $1 million per year locking people up just in the local jail system, not state prisons, not federal prisons, just the local jails. In some neighborhoods, it's more like $80 million per year is spent locking up local residents of certain neighborhoods. And we show that in those neighborhoods, these are our million-dollar hoods, the leading charges that are sending people to jail and to prison have, in the last 10 years, really been about possession of narcotics and DUIs. And our argument at million-dollar hoods is if we take that money out of policing and jails and we move it into counseling, into education, into housing, into family support services, that'll be a better investment of our public dollars in the health of all of our communities. So that's the work that we do at Million Dollar Hoods. It's a big data initiative that's talking about mass incarceration and over-policing and helping us to think about how else we can be spending our public dollars to invest in ourselves and our community.
And that's fascinating. Yeah, you're not just an expert in Mexican history, but also in African-American history. And I imagine that in many ways, the two overlap, the communities work together on certain initiatives. I know they do here locally in Portland.
Well, that's good to hear. I hope to learn more about that when I'm up there. I certainly am very honored to be a part of many organizing communities. And there certainly is profound leadership among Latinx folks and African-Americans who are always searching for and finding the connections of our struggles and how we can stand together to create better lives for all of us.
We have, for example, in Multnomah County, which is the largest county in Oregon by population, our county commission is majority women of color. Going back to your book, The Bad Mexicans book, you were telling the story of Meganista, the migrant rebels. Tell me about their story.
At the heart of this book, Bad Mexicans, is a story of a group of dissident journalists who are formerly led by a man named Ricardo Flores Magón. And so this group of people are known as the Magonistas, followers of Ricardo Flores Magón. And they begin their rebel writing in Mexico, and they're challenging the dictator in Mexico at the time, a man named Porfirio Díaz, who had really concentrated all political power in his office and who had opened up Mexico to foreign investors in a way that left many Mexicans, the vast majority of Mexicans, landless and working for very low wages and dangerous conditions in foreign-owned and domestic-owned enterprises, mining, railroads, industrial agriculture, and whatnot. So Ricardo Flores Magón and the Magonistas begin a newspaper where they start to chronicle the struggles of life under the dictatorship of Porfirio Díaz. Fio Diaz has their newspaper shut down, has them arrested multiple times, even issues a gag rule against them. No newspaper in Mexico published their writing. And so to be able to continue their revolt, their critique of the Diaz regime, they quietly flee Mexico and they come to the United States to relaunch their rebel newspaper, which is called Regeneración, or Regeneration. And the vast majority of this book is focused on their time here in the United States and their struggle to relaunch their newspaper, Regeneración, to establish a political party, El Partido Liberal Mexicano, PLM, and to establish an army, really an army of the dispossessed, of those Mexicans who are being forced out of Mexico because they were forced off of their land. And they're coming to the United States in search of work, but they still have dreams of returning to Mexico under better conditions. So they join this army of the Magonistas. They're miners, they're cotton pickers, they're migrant workers, they're all intellectuals, they're all political actors. And they raid Mexico from the United States four times between 1906 and 1908. An extraordinary set of campaigns that they launch. And so this book really chronicles their rise as a social movement, but also the efforts of the U.S. and Mexican government to undermine their campaign. You have the U.S. Postal Service, U.S. Marshals, U.S. Department of State, Department of War, officers across the country are really tracking down and hunting down these Magonistas who start to live in hideouts as fugitives while they try to launch their social revolution. And so it's an extraordinary story of a social movement on the rise, but also of two nations trying to suppress that movement and that they fail to suppress it. And the Magonistas, although they don't go on to lead the Mexican Revolution, that's why they're not these famous names of Pancho Villa and Emiliano Zapata, the folks that we know very well. They helped to give birth to the Mexican Revolution.
So interesting. How do you feel about being one of the Hatfield Lecture Series featured speakers this year?
Oh, I'm thrilled to come up to Portland and talk to everybody. I have lots of good friends in the area, incredible historians, but also movement leaders in the issue of mass incarceration, but also immigration reform. And so I'm just so thrilled to come and be in conversation with everybody and look forward to seeing you in person soon.
Have you heard much about the Oregon Historical Society, or did you know much about it before they reached out to you?
I didn't know much about it, although I've always wanted to come up and do research at the society, and I will be doing that for a little bit while I'm in town.
Oh, that's interesting. What are you looking into while you're here?
I'm writing a new book on the history of the U.S.-Mexico border, and so I'm curious to know if there are records in Oregon about the early period of the U.S.-Mexico border, when it really was the southern edge of Oregon and California in the 1820s and 30s.
Wow, that's great. Thank you so much for spending all this time with me. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks for doing this. Thanks, Annette.
Nice to meet you.
You too. Bye.
And that was my talk with Dr. Kelly Lytle Hernandez. She holds an endowed chair in history at UCLA, and she's the author of the award-winning book Bad Mexicans, Race, Empire, and Revolution in the Borderlands. Dr. Hernandez will be speaking in Portland on Tuesday night at 7 p.m. for the Oregon Historical Society's Hatfield Lecture Series at Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall. You can get tickets at ohs.org. You're listening to Speaking Freely with Annette Newell. Thanks for tuning in here on your favorite Alpha Media radio station. If you have a topic you would like to hear about on this show, please send me an email about it to annette.newell@alphamediausa.com. One more time, that's annette.newell@alphamediausa.com. Join us again next week and check out our Speaking Freely podcast on kxl.com.